Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced by WEKU and Dynamis Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Coming later in this hour, Emily Hackney on her New York Times bestseller, All That's Unseen, an Appalachian memoir, and Louisville attorney Brian Hera on his new book, Bourbon Justice, How Whiskey Law Shaped America. This week begins on the subject of something that's going to or has happened to all of us, aging. Question is, how can we deal with this fact of life in ways that make our senior years as enjoyable and pleasant as possible? And if you're not there yet, still in your 30s, 40s, or 50s, how should you be thinking about aging out of doing things that you take for granted now? Bill Goodman and primary care physician Jeff Fox begin a new Eastern Standard series, Healthy Aging. Their guest, New York Times aging and brain health writer Dana Smith.
Dana, thanks so much for joining us on this first of our episodes on healthy aging.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Jeff and I have talked about your work, and we've certainly read a lot of your material. And from all of that that you do for the New York Times on a regular basis, from the articles, from the Well column, in a variety of areas, from recommendations that you make, studies that you report on, there are interesting pieces on fitness and better sleep and all of that. It just seemed like to me, and one of the things that led us to beginning this segment on Eastern Standard, is that it seems like healthy aging is having a moment. Would you agree?
I would definitely agree, yeah. I think first off, you know, the quest for longevity or immortality isn't new. You know, one of the oldest human stories, I think, is the Epic of Gilgamesh and kind of the search for immortality. So this pursuit of longevity is not unique to 2026. But I think that, you know, we are faced with an aging population and kind of the reality of what that brings for folks. And people think about that. I think that the pandemic also had a lot of people kind of evaluating their own health and what they can do and take things into their own hands. And then on the other side, we really do have some exciting science that's happening. You know, there's certainly a lot of money pouring into this area from Silicon Valley. There's a lot of influencers who are telling you how to live your life and what to do. So I think it's really kind of a confluence of trends that we're seeing that has really led to this moment that longevity and healthy aging are having.
Well, Dana, you do a lot of writing about a lot of different things in terms of longevity. How do you sort through what might be true, what might be not so true, and not confuse people?
Yeah, you know, in all of my reporting, kind of regardless of the topic, I really am looking for consensus. It's pretty rare, actually, that I'll write about a single study. I think that, you know, science is an iterative process. It's always evolving. And so, you know, rather than focus on one single finding that I'm kind of, you know, bringing up to readers, I really want to look where there's a pretty large trend happening. So often I'll kind of do, you know, take a new study and use it as a step back to look at the topic as a whole. And so I think where we see consensus with healthy aging is frankly the really boring stuff. You know, it's diet, it's exercise, it's sleep, it's having strong social connections. It's, you know, trying to keep your stress levels low, taking care of, you know, other aspects of your physical health and mental health. And the really cutting edge or exciting research is exciting. It's maybe promising. It's maybe snake oil. It's hard to tell. But really what I try to report on and convey to readers where they should kind of invest their own time and money right now is really the boring stuff that we all know that we should be doing, but that science really says works. I think that's the kind of the exciting thing about it. It's not just, oh yeah, you know, get some exercise. It's, we can point to study after study after study that show how good it is for your brain and your body on kind of a cellular and molecular level.
Dan, you've said that you really do want to help readers understand the latest research that you look at and the recommendations that are meant for them. And you also do such a good job in explaining the evidence and also the risks involved in a lot of what's going on out there. So how do you do that in a way? And you mentioned first about this sort of new thinking on longevity. Is it necessarily always a positive thing that we're thinking about longevity, or are there some negative aspects to, as Jeff mentioned, what might be true and what may not be true? How do you delve into that and divide that up?
You know, when thinking about the research itself, one thing I always look for is whether there's data in humans. In people, it sounds pretty simple, but a lot of where the hype lies right now in kind of the more, I don't know, experimental longevity treatments is there's data in mice or cells or yeast, but there's not a lot of data in humans. And so I think when people are considering whether to take a supplement or a peptide, you know, kind of the hottest buzzword right now, you know, really think about where the evidence is actually coming from. And again, it's really those kind of fundamentals of health that we just have tons and tons of data in people to really back up these recommendations, whereas things that are more experimental, maybe that you've seen an influencer talk about, we really just don't have the data. And I think that is where the issue really lies, is that some of these things could be beneficial, but we don't have data to say that's true or not. We don't have a lot of clinical trials on many supplements and certainly not on peptides. And we also don't know if they're safe or not. So, you know, it could be that something works, but it could cause cancer in the long run. So, you know, there's just a lot of unknowns when it comes to kind of the more experimental longevity treatments. And that uncertainty is certainly frustrating. But I think it's something that's really important to convey, again, when people are thinking about where to invest their time and money, you know, both of which are not infinite resources. So, yeah, I think that's kind of how I really start to think about these things is what does the evidence say and where is the evidence from?
Well, Dana, you have written a lot about peptides and GLPs and things that may make longevity better. I have a lot of patients who take a lot of supplements who say, you know, this is going to help me. May or may not. And just because it's a supplement or something new doesn't mean it doesn't have a side effect also. So how do you tell people about that?
Yeah. And honestly, one of the biggest concerns with supplements in terms of their safety is what's in the pill. Does that actually match what's on the label, on the bottle? And I think that this is something that a lot of people don't necessarily understand that, you know, supplements and certainly peptides are not regulated in the way that an FDA approved drug is. You know, factories aren't being assessed and, you know, the what's in the supplement bottle oftentimes isn't being tested. So, you know, something could say that it's pure melatonin and it turns out that it has, you know, half of the amount that it says it does, or it could have twice as much as it says it does. And there could also be adulterants or kind of other contaminants that are in that pill. And we just don't know because it's just a much less regulated market. And so, you know, again, there's the question about efficacy and safety of what you think you're getting. And then there's the reality of what you might actually be getting, which could be totally different. And so that's where I really urge caution, especially when it comes to supplements. I think that your average multivitamin is fairly safe. But again, when you're seeing something that is sold by an influencer, maybe you've encountered it online or, you know, in a Reddit forum about longevity, like I think just really urging caution, do you actually know what you're taking? And another thing is what I often hear from researchers, which I really like, is why are you taking the supplement? You know, if someone has a deficiency in vitamin D or another nutrient, you know, then you're supplementing it with the pill. But if you're at a healthy state, then more isn't necessarily better. And so I think really thinking about the rationale of why you're taking something is an important step as well.
Dana, do you think that the research, the science that is being done today is more helpful for individuals, just average citizens, when they're looking at a healthier lifestyle or the possibility that they might live beyond the average age of men and women? That has to be a good thing, but it also has to be measured in a certain way that they don't go, as you have talked about, beyond reason and to take something that they're not really comfortable with or that their primary physician or their geriatric care person hasn't recommended for them. Even though we're all striving to live better, to live longer, that has to be taken with a measure of caution.
Yeah, one trend that I think is really interesting and potentially has a lot of promise is the trend in longevity medicine of doing a lot of testing and kind of personalized medicine and also a lot of preventive medicine. When I speak with longevity clinicians or people who, you know, say they practice quote unquote longevity medicine, that's a really big emphasis, is that it's a big focus on prevention. So we want to not only treat you when you have diabetes, but treat you when you have prediabetes or even stop you from developing prediabetes. And we want it to be personalized to you. And so that can involve a lot of blood testing or a continuous glucose monitor, or, you know, a full body MRI. And I think that these are very seductive. Like, we all want to know, or many of us want to know more about ourselves and kind of what our risks are and what we can do to prevent it. And so I think that the field has really good intentions in that way. But again, there's a gap in that we don't actually know if a personalized treatment is better for someone than, again, the kind of standard recommendations of eat fruits and vegetables and get 7 to 8 hours of sleep and get, you know, 150 minutes of physical activity every week. We know stopping disease early, preventing disease from starting is very, very important. You know, I think preventive medicine is really essential, you know, a bedrock of our medical system. But what we don't know is if we really tweak and personalize and tailor a recommendation to you as an individual, will you get a better outcome than if you just follow the standard guidelines to eat healthy and exercise and sleep well? We could, we just don't know. We just don't have the data yet.
Dani, you did a recent article on a blood test to predict Alzheimer's disease. You know, when I do that with patients, I said, okay, when we're doing a blood test to predict something, what are you going to do with that information? And so I'm not sure how reliable that test is, or does it change anything we do? I mean, if it's positive, you say diet and exercise. If it's negative, you say diet and exercise. What do you think?
I think that's a great point. And I actually just had another story about that exact test this morning. And, you know, I really understand why people want to take it. You know, many people who are taking these as a potential predictive test, you know, they've seen their parents or other loved ones succumb to Alzheimer's. It's a devastating condition. And I think a lot of people want to know what does their future hold and how can they potentially plan for it. But it's also really scary to get that information when, like you say, you know, the recommendations kind of whether you are at risk or not is diet and exercise. And with Alzheimer's in particular, that could change. You know, there are some clinical trials right now that are happening that are taking the drugs that are already approved to treat Alzheimer's, which have a fairly modest effect, and seeing if they could be used in people who are at risk to either prevent or delay them from developing symptoms. And I think that would be a real breakthrough moment in Alzheimer's care. A lot of neurologists are very excited about the potential for these drugs, but we just don't know if they work yet. Those clinical trials, they're happening, and we hope to have results, I think, in the next year or two. And I think if those are positive, then that would really change things for Alzheimer's treatment in a really exciting way. But it's a huge if, and we just don't know yet. You know, so many drugs have been tried for Alzheimer's and haven't worked. So there's a lot of hope being put on these medications, and maybe they will work and maybe they won't. We'll just have to wait and see.
Dana, what would you like the end game to be for the greater society? Do you want people to hear that growing older in a healthy way, doing all the things that you've mentioned a couple of times, is more important than becoming or striving to be a super ager or looking at that longevity age growing from 80 to 110 and still being able to function? I know they're probably one and the same, but should people be so concerned about the ages that they get to and that they are going to try to achieve, or is it living healthy every single day?
I think it's the latter. And frankly, you know, I love reading through the comments on my articles because people are so sensible in how they respond to them. When you talk to kind of the really out there longevity scientists, they say, oh, everyone can live to 120. And I think very few people actually want to do that. They just, you know, want to be as healthy as they can be for as long as possible. They want to be able to travel in retirement. They want to be able to play with their grandchildren. And I think that that's most people's goal with healthy aging is a really practical lens on it. And I think that's a really healthy perspective, frankly. I think that's kind of the better way to go. And if you can live longer because you're healthier and more active, then that's wonderful. But I think, you know, getting the most out of your years is really most people's goal when it comes to healthy aging.
Dana, I think the key you said there is healthy. It's not, we can keep people alive a long time, but you don't necessarily want to do that if it's not a good, healthy life too.
Exactly. And there is a term, health span, that a lot of researchers use when thinking about this. So it's not necessarily your lifespan, how long you live, but it's how long you live healthy. And I will say that a lot of the scientists that I really respect, who I think are doing really interesting work, that's more their focus. They want people to be healthy until 80 rather than living to, and you know, and then maybe die 82 rather than living to 120, but being in poor health for, you know, the last several decades of their life. So they're really trying to push out when people develop these diseases of aging, things like Alzheimer's and dementia, diabetes, cardiovascular disease. So that's a goal with a lot of the research, which I think very much maps onto people's own goals for themselves, is just to stay healthier for longer.
Dana, Dr. Fox and I are hopefully going to have several segments on Eastern Standard on a variety of health issues and healthy aging issues. They won't all be scientifically researched, but they might be on how not to fall as you get older. What can you do about frailness? Why getting a dog or a pet in your latter years is good for you? Some things like that. It's not geared just for those 75 and 85-year-old listeners. The message should be getting to the 40, 50, and 60-year-olds at the same time. So as we wrap up on this first segment of Healthy Aging, what would you like for the listeners to hear? What tip or two can you give them about starting earlier with healthy aging, or for someone who's at the point where they maybe are beginning to think about those latter years? What would you like to say to them?
That's such a great point. I'm glad you brought that up. I spoke with one researcher recently who said what happens in midlife doesn't stay in midlife. So, you know, that's really kind of where the seeds are planted for healthy aging, is, you know, in your 40s and 50s. So I think that, you know, starting early is a great thing to consider. You know, exercise is really just seems to be the number one thing that I hear over and over again from scientists and doctors, of just the best thing that you can do for your health long term. And that doesn't have to mean, you know, a really intense run. It can just be going for a walk after dinner. And one tip I've heard from a lot of people is go for a walk every day, and ideally go for a walk with a friend, because then you're getting some exercise, you're getting some social time. And, you know, I am in midlife, I have young children, you know, you don't have a whole lot of time at this age in life. And so I think trying to be realistic about what's possible for people and just going for a walk every day, I think is hopefully something that many of us can do.
Dr. Fox, sounds like a good idea to me.
Let's go take a walk.
Let's do that. Dana Smith from the New York Times, a health and wellness expert, reporter, correspondent who's been doing this work for a long time. We certainly thank you for joining us on this first segment of Eastern Standard.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard. And if you just joined us, the hour began with a debut, a new series on healthy aging hosted by Bill Goodman and Dr. Jeff Fox. If you missed it and would like to listen, you'll find the segment on our homepage at esweku.org. Emily Hackney, fresh out of Harvard, is out with her first book, All That's Unseen, an Appalachian memoir, published by Penguin Press. It's Emily's account of an early life about as far removed from that Ivy League campus in Cambridge as you can get. Emily grew up in the Appalachian coalfields town of Tazewell, Virginia, a childhood marked by family dynamics, poverty, and an increasingly intense experience of religious and spiritual control and rebellion. As a teenager, Emily entered a conservative Pentecostal world and became engaged to an older boyfriend whose very controlling influence over her was reinforced by the church's teachings about female obedience and unquestioned male authority. Threading through much of this memoir are accounts of an all-out battle between independence and intuition versus submission. Along the way, she deals beautifully with the assumptions and stereotypes of Appalachian people. Emily Hackney joins us now. Welcome.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, let's begin with your favorite place on the planet, Tazewell, Virginia. Take us there, if you would.
Well, first of all, I've got to commend you on pronouncing it right, because I rarely hear people pronounce it correctly. So it is a tiny town in Southwest Virginia. The county borders West Virginia. Coal fields, also agriculture. I'd say it's about a 50-50 split. Just a small place, beautiful landscape. Everybody knows everybody, that kind of thing. It's a gorgeous place if you're ever able to visit.
There's a great deal of affection for Tazewell in this book. And even so, this is also the place where some very difficult, some very bad things happened to you. As a young girl and then as a teenager, what were you searching for? What did you want life to make clear to you?
What an interesting question. I don't know. I think that because I didn't know, I found myself in this church I'd grown up in, but I found myself becoming more deeply involved in it because, you know, it offered answers to what your life should look like, how a person should be, how a woman should be.
Reading along as you're going through this indoctrination, if you will, and frequent church services, you seem constantly baffled by what you're hearing and experiencing and seeing. Am I right about that?
In a way, I was, and in a way, I wasn't, because it was something that I grew up seeing. But at the same time, it was so extreme, as in the charismatic element of speaking in tongues and people falling out in the spirit. That's, you know, shocking to a child. It feels very violent, feels very unnatural. But in a way, it also felt natural for the atmosphere of the church that I was in. And, you know, I came to see that it was what everybody did. It was expected of you.
Why do we need to understand the genuine emotional and the spiritual appeal of the church in order to understand what happened to you?
Well, I think there's something very valuable in that charismatic expression of faith. It allows people to be something that they're not in regular life. And I think that that's a huge appeal. It was an appeal to me to feel like I had this very personal, tangible connection with God through experiencing, you know, these visions and speaking in tongues and these feelings of God inhabiting my body. That was a huge draw for me.
I don't want to give anything away here, but that comes back in a very interesting way, way later in the book, when you're talking to a psychiatrist, I believe. Anyway.
It sure does.
Another relationship was becoming increasingly important in your life, especially in your teenage years. You became engaged to Sam, an older boyfriend. Over your parents' objections, they didn't like him. And the church taught that submission to the man that you intended to marry would be evidence of virtue. How did the authority of the church and Sam's authority over you begin to reinforce one another?
You know, I talk about in the book how it was never explicitly taught that men are superior to women. It was always implicit. It was always these subtle messages. And, you know, that subtlety over time in a child's mind becomes a reality. It's like, this is accepted as truth. And so I accepted it as true. And at the same time, you know, I'm 14, I'm getting in a relationship with an 18-year-old. I have heard these messages of what a good woman is, what a good girlfriend, what a good wife is. And so as I'm entering into this relationship and getting deeper into it, I have these messages in my mind of how I should be meek and submissive. And, you know, even if these words were not always specifically used, I know in my head that I should be somebody who's appealing to a man. I should be deferential to his authority.
Well, then you write of a time when reason and reality were at war with your faith. Was there a particular moment when you began to distinguish a difference between spiritual devotion and surrendering your own judgment?
I think the moment stands out in my mind. So I worked at Subway for several years while I was living in Tazewell. This was my high school job. And I had a manager there that she embodied everything that I was taught to believe was bad, that made a woman bad. You know, she had children by several different men, and she'd been in prison, and she'd struggled with addiction. And, you know, in my mind, she was supposed to be the worst person. Like, that's just the worst person you could possibly be. And I was very judgmental of her. But her character was just so kind and so giving. And so it made me question, why am I believing this? What do I believe about this woman, and how is that maybe not entirely true? You know, I had this very black and white way of thinking about people, and she fell somewhere in the gray area, and I had never encountered that before. So it was difficult for me to reckon who she was with who I was taught to think she was.
The relationship that I mentioned earlier with Sam, your boyfriend, and who you became engaged to, you describe as painful, deeply disturbing, and I don't want to give away too much of that part of your story since it really does inform a lot of what follows, but What followed was the realization that you'd come very close to becoming an obedient teenage mom, driven by an assumption that nearly everything you did or thought was a sin. As you wrote those scenes, how did you resist judging the girl that you had been with the knowledge that you have now?
You know, when I originally wrote those scenes, I wrote them just a few years out of that relationship, and I was still very angry. I was very angry at what had happened to me, angry that I'd been manipulated and lied to, and just angry that I'd been in this relationship. And I think there was a lot of self-blame because I was so close to the occurrence of it actually happening. But I spent 7 years on this book, and I rewrote scenes over and over and over until the anger started to slowly bleed out of it, and more empathy, I suppose, for myself, and less self-blame. You know, as you get older, you change your perspective on who you were when you were younger. And because I have that gift of time now, I can look back and see, you know, it was very easy for me to be manipulated in a relationship. I was so young. So I have a lot of empathy for younger Emily.
Well, listener, I would say when you read this book, and I strongly urge you to read this book, you're going to see that there was a need for catharsis here that most of us don't experience. I mean, there was a true need for catharsis, and you went a little bit wild for a time. You wanted to become somebody new, looking for love or at least attention, companionship maybe in all the wrong places.
Certainly. I mean, I think that this also goes back to things that I was taught about what I should be like as a woman and you know, what my value was. I grew up believing that much of my value was reflected back to me in a relationship with a man, that a man's opinion of me was most of my value. And that was a belief that, you know, took a long time to get rid of. So yeah, I sought out validation in many relationships because I was just looking for this thing that I had inside myself, but I didn't know that at the time.
Let's get back to the title. The title is All That's Unseen. And you've said in other interviews that I've watched that there were several paths that led to that choice of words. What does that title mean to you now? What was unseen?
Yeah, there's so many elements of my book where I'm kind of touching on this theme of invisibility. You know, the large one is probably where I'm at Harvard and I just don't feel seen for myself as a person. I feel that I'm seen as a stereotype. I'm a walking stereotype. People only see my background. They only think of Appalachia in certain terms. So I just felt invisible on the Harvard campus, invisible in the world at large. But there are other elements to it too. You know, the spiritual aspect of what I experienced in my church, the Holy Spirit is this unseen thing, and it's hard to understand what it is and even describe how you experience it, but it's there. It's something that can't be explained. And obviously it's an invisible thing that's around you, but you can feel it. There are other elements too. You know, I talk about my dad telling stories. He would tell stories about these monsters in the woods. And I just had this feeling of Appalachia as I knew it. It's this wild thing that was there to be explored, but you didn't know what was really there. And that's kind of what my book is about. Like, what's beneath the surface of everything that you see and what you're taught to believe.
Well, given your experiences, your life takes an extraordinary turn. You were working two jobs, sometimes 7 days a week, going to community college. You had applied to several state colleges, and you decided to give Harvard a try. I think you got accepted to Columbia, correct?
I did.
But Harvard was a long shot, and you didn't think you could afford it, for one thing. And then one day, you got a phone call. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I should say, yeah, I had no, I kind of applied as a joke. I mean, I write about this in the book, but, you know, the ex-boyfriend didn't think I could do it. So I had to apply just out of spite. But I did it the night of the application deadline because I didn't think I had a serious chance. So when I get the call, at first I'm like, well, this is a joke. You know, I'm being punked. And it didn't really sink in until I went to visit a few weeks later. My family took me up there to visit, and I was like, oh my gosh, this is where I'm going to be. This is real. Like, I have a place here on this campus. I actually got into Harvard. It was so surreal. It almost didn't have meaning until I actually experienced it for myself.
You know, this is a part of your story that I really wanted to kind of drill into for just a second or two, because so many of us have experienced it. There's an old expression, getting above your raisin. Do they say that in Tazewell?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, it carries a warning about ambition. Don't start thinking you're better than where you came from. There's a deep loyalty to place and people. Did going to Harvard create any tension between wanting that larger life that you were seeking and feeling loyal to the people and the place that it made you?
Oh, absolutely. I think that's at the core of what I write about, is this tension of where do I belong after I've left? You know, growing up in a small town, you know people, not many people, but you know people that leave, and then they're kind of judged afterwards. They're not seen the same way. If they return, they're kind of met with a little bit of suspicion and maybe distrust. Like, why did you leave us? You're maybe a traitor now. You don't really belong the same way that you did. And so I felt that, you know, just being away for a single year, I come back home, it's my summer break, and I'm starting to realize that people think different things of me now that I've gone to Harvard. They're surprised I haven't lost my accent. They ask me if I talk with my accent up there. You know, they think that suddenly my political views are just entirely different from what they were before. I'm met with a little bit of distrust. Like, she left us for this big city. Maybe she's not the person we thought that she was. And so it was difficult. It was a reckoning between, do I belong to this place that I once called home? Do I belong to this place that is not really home, but I'm living at? I felt caught in this strange in-between of two places.
I read in the book that you encountered another thing that many of us who've left and come back encountered, especially when we've gone to places like Boston or New York, that people have their assumptions about Appalachia. They are, of course, wrapped up in the stereotypes and the tropes that are out there. What stereotypes about the place that you came from do you recall encountering at Harvard, and did any of them surprise or anger you?
I would say most of them angered me. Mm-hmm. just because they felt very outlandish. I went to Harvard in 2017, so it was on the heels of the 2016 election. Appalachia had gotten a lot of largely negative attention for the way it largely voted. So people had in their head that I was very conservative, that I was some kind of backwards, ignorant, uneducated person. I got questions like, have you ever shot a gun before? You know, just funny things that, or things that struck me as funny that I wouldn't think were polite to ever ask somebody, mm-hmm. but people felt very comfortable asking me these questions that I felt like were somewhat invasive.
Near the end of the book, you're at Harvard still. You are researching for an essay, and you come across an issue of Life magazine from 1964 that really grabbed your attention. And then later, a 2006 book about Appalachia that you hoped would be an improvement on what you had read in Life magazine. It wasn't. What came out of those discoveries?
It made me realize that people outside Appalachia, at least in my experience, seem like they want to see Appalachia in a certain way, and not necessarily a positive way. It seemed like the easiest thing to do was to characterize Appalachia by its stereotypes and to portray it as such. And that really made me mad, because it was like there's no room for nuance in the national conversation about what Appalachia is. It was just perpetually portrayed in the same way over and over again, just the negative stereotypes, you know, toothless men and people drinking Mountain Dew and trailers and trash thrown by the side of the road. It was just a very negative image of Appalachia just being portrayed over and over and over.
Coming back around to life in Tazewell, one of the things that you observe in the book is that people can live in the very same small town, know many of the same people, encounter many of the same circumstances, and still understand the world in radically different ways. The people in the Deliverance Church viewed life one way. You were seeing it in a different way, increasingly so. It startled you that we're all here in the same building, the same place. I'm not thinking what they're thinking. Can you talk to me about it a bit?
Yeah, I'm thinking about, you know, how I worked at, like I said, I worked at Subway, and I was very involved in this church. And so basically everything's a sin, like you were saying. I believe everything's a sin. I'm so scared of living. I'm so scared of life, of doing the wrong thing. And then I'm working here with coworkers that are just out smoking and drinking and partying and cussing, which just, you know, horrified me. it was such an interesting perspective to see how people could live much differently than me. But that makes you question, like, why am I living this way? You know, and I think it's important that you're exposed to all different kinds of people. And these are not people that I've never met before. I mean, I would say I was in the minority of being a very religious person in Tazewell. Plenty of other people there were religious, but not so as much as me or as people in my church. Plenty of people, you know, would drink and smoke, but not, you know, excessively. Everybody falls somewhere on the spectrum.
So, Emily, you still call Tazewell your favorite place on earth, but the person looking at Tazewell now is not the girl that we met at the beginning of this book. You're a new mom. Mm-hmm. You have a little girl. I wondered, how does the experience that you've detailed in this book inform you as a mother now?
I think about my experiences as a young girl, as a teenager. And of course, you know, this mother's instinct, you want to protect your child, but you also want her to be independent and make decisions for herself. And I don't know that I have enough parenting experience to say how I would balance those two things. In a way, I feel very sad that I'm not raising her in Tazewell, that I'm not raising her in Southwest Virginia, because I live in Central Virginia now, not too far away, but it's still different. And then at the same time, I also am happy to hopefully give her more opportunities than I had growing up.
Well, full confession here, I've been riveted by this book, so riveted that I was still reading it right after the minute when I had to leave for the studio. I've just finished taking in your Harvard experience, and that alone could be a book, in my book. But I'm going to finish it tonight, I promise. But in the meantime, what do you hope I'll carry with me from the experience of All That's Unseen, an Appalachian memoir?
Well, I know that you know Appalachia is a very diverse place. It's not one thing. It's not its stereotypes. I largely wrote it because I wanted the world to see that, or at least, you know, a few people to see it. It's kind of blown up in a way I haven't expected, but I've gotten a lot of messages from people who have thanked me for helping them understand their experience in Appalachia, or even outside of Appalachia. You know, they're not Appalachian, but they found themselves in a place that they don't feel like they belong in, or they've struggled in, you know, a difficult religious setting or a difficult relationship. So I hope that you're able to relate to some of the themes in it in the way that other people have reached out to me and told me they have.
You know, it just dawned on me, I've got to ask you this. It's one thing to graduate from Harvard alone. That's a huge deal. But then this book lands on the New York Times bestseller list. That had to be a pretty happy moment.
It sure was. It was extremely unexpected, and I still don't quite feel like it's real.
Well, it sure is. Emily Hackney is author of All That's Unseen, an Appalachian memoir published by Penguin Press. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's just been wonderful to talk to you.
Joining us now is Brian Hara, a Louisville attorney and author of Bourbon Justice, How Whiskey Law Shaped America. It's a book about bourbon, certainly, but it's also a book about contracts, trademarks, regulation, consumer protection, taxation, fraud, and the ways a young nation tried to define fairness in the marketplace. Hara's central idea is a striking one. If you want to understand American commercial law, you could do worse than begin with a barrel of whiskey. Bourbon was not just something Americans made, sold, drank, taxed, and fought over. It was something they litigated, and those fights over names, quality, ownership, labels, taxes, and reputation helped shape the legal rules that still govern business today. Brian Hara joins us now. Welcome, Brian.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
The title of your book makes a striking claim, Bourbon Justice, How Whiskey Law Shaped America. So before we get into the cases themselves, what first convinced you that the history of bourbon was also, in a meaningful way, a history of American law?
Well, it started with stumbling upon an old trademark case from 1881. A lot of what I do during the day deals with trademark litigation, and I stumbled upon an 1881 case that involved the James Pepper Distillery and LeBrow and Graham, which is now Woodford Reserve. And I found this remarkable decision. It was written by a U.S. Supreme Court justice, and it analyzed what a trademark really was. And I ended up using this case in litigation where I argued before the Sixth Circuit in 2018. So I'm using 1881 authority today. And that's really what drove me to look for other cases in the bourbon industry. And slowly but surely, I found that because warehouses and distilleries were really dangerous places in the 1800s with open flywheels grabbing workers' arms and chewing them up and barrels falling three stories and crushing people, bourbon was the source of workplace safety laws. I found that with selling interests in barrels, essentially like negotiable instruments, bourbon had a role in setting the law for negotiable instruments. It had a role in setting contract law because everything to do with bourbon, from its distillation to its warehousing to its selling, all dealt with contracts. And trademark really was at the forefront of American litigation. If it weren't bourbon, it may have been something else, but bourbon was the industry of the day. It's the industry that had high competitiveness, and it's the first industry that realized that it needed to protect its name, image, and likeness.
Well, I want to ask about a specific point that you discuss early in the book, the problem of rectifiers and adulterated whiskey and the eventual passage of the Bottled in Bond Act in 1897 at a time when questionable products could be altered, colored, or flavored and still sold as whiskey. What was really at stake in that fight, and why do you see it as an important chapter in the history of consumer protection?
Well, to start from the end, it was the nation's first Consumer Protection Act. Think of this time frame, and you might remember in high school reading The Jungle. So a lot of us know that meatpacking plants were not only dangerous, but that packers were adding all sorts of chemicals and preservatives into the meat, and you really weren't sure what you were getting. It turns out that milk production was bad as well. There was an incentive to thin the milk with water, and it wasn't always clean water. So if you've ever seen watered down milk, you know you need to thicken it up. So chalk and those sorts of things were added to thicken the milk. Candy was made with different sorts of minerals that turned out to be poisonous to give it bright color. There were false medicinal claims being made left and right. There were medicines that used things like cocaine. So there were all these dangerous products for the American consumer. But the first Consumer Protection Act was the Bottled and Bond Act of 1897, which I find remarkable. To go back around to the front of your question, rectifiers caused this because they could essentially take vodka and add coloring and flavoring agents. Some of them were safe, but a lot of them weren't safe. I found a case where hydrochloric acid was added to it, and another where tobacco spit was used for the coloring. So incredibly gross at the least and dangerous in other cases, additives were used by these rectifiers, who would basically start with vodka, which you can distill in a day, add your ingredients to it, and by the night, you could have something that looked and more or less tasted like whiskey. And there were no laws that prohibited these rectifiers from calling their concoction a 10-year Kentucky bourbon whiskey when it was made yesterday. So I could have come in as a rectifier and I could have called it Harrah's Old Crow whiskey, because there wasn't really any protection that Old Crow could have asserted against me for me using its brand. So it was this intertwining of both consumer protection and IP protection that really had producers of straight bourbon whiskey and these rectifiers fighting on all fronts for about 40 years.
Gosh, hearing all that, it's a wonder we've made it this far.
it's remarkable sometimes.
Yeah. There is this interesting tension running through the book between freewheeling entrepreneurship and the need for rules. Were the early bourbon distillers asking government to stay out of their business, or when it suited them, asking the law to protect their brands and products?
It was an evolution. Initially, they didn't want the government involved at all. And that's, I think, how a lot of business started and this caveat emptor mindset started. And bourbon wasn't taxed all of the time. It actually was the nation's first excise tax. And every time we fought a war, they would reinstitute the tax. And during the Civil War, they reinstituted the tax again on bourbon production, on all whiskey production. And it's stuck ever since then. The first distiller who embraced high taxation and who embraced this government involvement and this bureaucracy involved in whiskey production was Colonel E.H. Taylor. And it was groundbreaking for a distiller to embrace those sorts of things. But it was also connected to the fight against rectifiers. He thought that if he made his Kentucky Straight Bourbon whiskey, and it had the endorsement of the federal government, not only through the Bottle and Bond Act, which gave it a sense of purity, but he paid his taxes. He could tell everyone in the world that his bourbon whiskey was the only whiskey, not the rectifier's whiskey, that was guaranteed to be pure.
He emerges in the book as an especially important, but also a complicated figure in this history. Why complicated?
He was certainly gregarious. He certainly could convince people to like him, but deep down, he committed a lot of fraud. He sold the same barrel of whiskey several times over, and it caught up with him a few times during his life. He was a roller coaster as far as ups and downs in the success of his business. And we look to him today as the first person to marry both the traditional way of making bourbon and making it in a more industrial, modern setting. So we see a lot of that through a lot of the distillers. I think a lot of them would be distasteful to our common sense that we have today. But I think it makes it all the more interesting. This is the world that existed then, and I think we have to always remind ourselves of that.
You write about lawsuits involving names, reputations, and ownership, and in a business that's built around family names and inherited identities, what happened when the law had to decide who actually had the right to a name?
This is one of the areas where bourbon law led the development of this area of American commercial law. A lot of times a distiller would have someone learning at his feet, and that was most often a son. So you have your apprentice, it's your son. Sometimes you have many sons. Each of the sons open their own distilleries. They're all using the same name. And this happened with the Dant family, which is more of a bottom shelf whiskey today, but it was a very popular whiskey in the 1800s. Once they sold to larger conglomerates, they sued each other over who could use Dant. There was also a lawsuit over Maker's Mark. The Maker's Mark family had been distillers for five generations, and when they split off and formed Maker's Mark, they initially wanted to call themselves the T.W. Samuels Distillery. A court ruled they couldn't do it. There are plenty of examples through bourbon history of when you can use your own name and when you can't. And to boil it down to a nutshell, it's essentially whether or not you're going to cause confusion. So were there earlier family members that used that name? If that's the case, you're probably going to cause confusion. If you're the first one to use your name, or if you've been using your name before the others did, then you're more likely to be able to use your name on your own label.
Well, there is also a larger American story here. As the country moved from a relatively unregulated economy toward a more modern system of commercial law, what can the bourbon industry tell us about that transition?
Well, each time that bourbon surged in popularity over the last two centuries, we've seen charlatans, forgeries, cheats, tax evaders, all of those each time. And each time we've responded by embracing that we're a nation of laws. And sometimes it takes a little too long to enact a new law. Other times the pendulum of overregulation shifts too far, like it did for prohibition. But looking at the broad picture, what I see in bourbon is that bourbon helped create a level playing field, fair competition, and through the Bottled and Bond Act and other federal law, helped create a product that can be as safe as it can be. It's alcohol, so a lot of folks will say it's not safe, but it's a product that is as safe as it can be. That's what I've learned about this tug of back and forth with regulation throughout American commerce, and I think bourbon is a great case study for this.
Well, Brian, after researching all of these lawsuits and feuds and questionable practices and larger-than-life characters and personalities, was there one case or one character that most changed your own understanding of the bourbon industry?
It has to be Colonel Taylor again. We brought him up earlier, but he was not only a huge figure in bourbon, but he was the most litigious by far. I could have cited another 20 cases in bourbon justice that involved Colonel Taylor. He was involved in litigation with George T. Stagg for about 13 years over Stagg's use of Taylor's name. He had another 10-year stint of litigation against another Colonel Taylor. If you can believe it or not, there were two Colonel Taylors making whiskey at the same time. He was just as likely to be sued as he was to sue. And he helped establish a lot of the laws that we take for granted today. So he's really the one that I think I owe as an inspiration for bourbon justice.
Well, when somebody pours a glass of bourbon after reading Bourbon Justice, what do you hope they see in that glass that they might not have seen before?
Well, I hope that they see that through becoming a nation of laws, it's an ongoing process of finding a balance that avoids things like being too paternalistic or taxing an industry into oblivion. We tried both of those. We tried taking away liberties. But it's a balance with protecting consumers and providing a safe product and protecting workers. And the bourbon industry, through lawsuits that came out of Kentucky, did all of those things. And I hope people can see that we can find that balance, and we can find it in other industries, and we can find it in other aspects of our lives, too.
That's Brian Hara, Louisville attorney and author of Bourbon Justice, How Whiskey Law Shaped America. Thank you so much, Brian.
Well, thanks so much for having me, and I appreciate your interest.
Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced by WEKU and Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're on the WEKU, Apple, Spotify, and NPR apps, and you can stream all of the interviews from this week's edition online at esweku.org. And while you're there, you can check out our contributors and their interview archives. Send thoughts and suggestions to es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard.